The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Teen Vogue and the Teen Magazine. The first article is from the Teen Magazine, and it's titled, Five Lessons I've Learned as a High School Senior. Entering high school, I had absolutely no friends, which meant I had to make them myself by socializing with others. I'd already learned a lot about fake friends and bullying throughout middle school, so I carried those lessons into freshman year. High school is all about making mistakes and figuring out who you want to be. But I wish I'd had a little more advice, which is why I want to share five lessons I've learned so far throughout my high school career. Number one, be bold and be you. As cliche as it may sound, being yourself truly makes a difference. Whether you're loud and silly or shy and quiet, you can attract the type of people you want in your life just by being you. I cannot stress this concept enough, but being social and bold will honestly make you more likable and approachable by others. Overall, we live on a floating rock in the middle of space, meaning people's opinions about you don't matter. If I've learned anything over this past year, it's that life is super short, so why waste it pleasing others or being too embarrassed to be yourself? Embarrassment lasts in the moment, but the memories will last forever. Number two, not all friendships are meant to last. This piece of advice is not only for high schoolers, but all grade levels. Trust me when I say I've had my fair share of girl drama and fallouts with friends. It's taken me a long time to come to the realization that half the friends you make in elementary or middle school are not real friends who will stick with you even when you may not be the most popular person around. Genuine friends don't care about small-minded concepts like your social status. They don't try to one-up you every chance they get. Friends lift each other up and make you so happy you cry over the thought of losing them. They don't make you feel like a burden or that you're not important. Most people will experience toxic friendships at one point in time, but it's important to keep in mind that what made them toxic and how to avoid that in the future. Some friendships may just come to a natural end, and there could be many reasons that feel unknown, but you'll just know when that time has come. Number three, don't be a bystander, stand up. Sadly, over the years, I've experienced and watched racism occur in my own school. Don't get me wrong, I love my school, and many of the people in it, but that doesn't excuse the few bad apples. I've always been the type of person to stand up for others who didn't feel like they could speak up, because I have a very compassionate and nurturing heart. If you ever hear any type of bullying going on, don't be shy and back off. Say something to those bullies. Say it to their faces, or remove the person being bullied from the situation. No one deserves to be treated horribly. We're all the same. We're all human. When racist acts of bullying occur, I take the time to educate those who don't know any better and, disappointingly, weren't taught properly by their parents. Number four, enjoy the little moments. Since freshman year, I've been looking forward to being a senior and moving away to college. Now that the time has actually come, I'm extremely nervous and scared about starting this new chapter in my life. This past summer has made me realize that life is so precious, and I'm never going to be as young as I am today. So by breathing in the air and capturing my surroundings through my eyes, I can fully live in the moment. I don't know how to exactly describe it, but enjoying the little moments creates a feeling of peace and true serenity. Number five, everything happens for a reason. I never truly understood the phrase, everything happens for a reason, until now. Life hasn't always gone my way, but in the end, I've learned a lot about myself and my surroundings. I know it's super difficult to fully grasp and understand this concept, but once you begin to go with the flow and let life take its course, you feel so much happier. Overthinking has led me to bawling my eyes out at 2 a.m. when I could have just remembered not to take life so seriously. Boy drama, grades on tests, losing friends, have all taught me a valuable lesson that I wouldn't have learned if I hadn't gone through the experience. This is exactly why everything happens for a reason. To teach you a lesson in the end, or to create memories that will last a lifetime. Overall, whatever you're going through, keep in mind, you will come out stronger, wiser, and your best self. This article was written by Nika Gods. Nika Gods is a current senior in high school from California who was born and raised in New York City. She found her love for writing and fashion while growing up in the Big Apple and decided to put the two together and create her fashion blog, Trendsetter. In a typical week, you can find Nika writing for her blog, researching the latest fashion trends, playing tennis, volunteering, creating content for her Instagram, and hanging out with her best friends. Nika dreams of being a writer and reporter for a lifestyle magazine one day, or working in the world of marketing and advertising. The next article is from Teen Vogue. It's titled, Remote School Was a Lifeline for Chronically Ill and Disabled Students. This article is by Fortessa Latifi and was published September 17th, 2021. Vera and Vicky, whose names have been changed for the story, Vera and Vicky are medically vulnerable high school students going back to school at a public school in New York where there's no remote school option for the fall semester. The only option to have remote schooling is if they actually contract COVID-19. There is an option to have an in-home instruction via the New York public school system, but the pair said their experience with remote instruction is that it gets hard. It's hard to get. The sisters will return in person, so Vicky wonders if the needs of chronically ill students like her were actually considered. Do they care? She asked. Every answer to that question is alarming to me. At school, you're supposed to feel safe. It's difficult to feel safe in public, indoor settings amid the surge of the highly contagious Delta COVID variant. While there are safe ways for many students to return to in-person learning, the chronically ill, disabled, or medically vulnerable students who are at a higher risk of contracting COVID and having complications, that feeling of safety is even more elusive. Vera and Vicky both have underlying health conditions that make them more susceptible to contracting COVID, but their biggest fear is bringing the virus home to their medically vulnerable mother. Vera said it's hard to prepare for the new school year when her overwhelming thought is, let's try not to get this illness and die or get mom killed. Still, the sisters don't have a choice but to take the risk. My hands are tied, Vera said. My mom's hands are tied. For our school, at least, Vicky said, it feels like they've ignored the fact that remote learning is a necessity for some students. But the debate between remote and in-person schooling isn't a simple one. While remote options provide necessary accessibility for disabled or chronically ill students, fully remote school posed learning and mental health challenges for others. The benefits of in-person schooling are clear, but so are the drawbacks. The answer would seem to be to provide multiple options, but that's not so simple either. Alina Silva, an education policy editor at New America, said the short answer for why many schools aren't offering remote options is school districts have been challenged by this as much as, if not more than, most institutions, except healthcare. We're asking underfunded and undersupported schools to provide resources in two ways. Instead of in-person school, Blue, another individual whose name has been changed, a 19-year-old high school senior in Arizona who uses they and he pronouns, is going to an online charter school. Blue has had 2 kidney transplants, and his body is currently in a phase of rejection of the second kidney. Because of their weakened immune system, Blue's mother, Christine, has always taken Blue out of school during flu season. But now the risk is simply is too dire to risk going back to school in person. Blue won't survive COVID. I cannot risk them, Christine said. Their education is not worth their life. No one's is. Blue is attending their senior year of high school through an entirely remote academy. Although they miss the social aspect of school, they prefer online learning. Instead of worrying about missing school for doctor's appointments and hospitalizations, they can just log on when they feel well and get their work done. And this way, they're protected. Online school has really helped me feel safer, Blue said. Christine feels alone in the fight to keep Blue safe. It feels like I've been abandoned. It feels like people don't care whether Blue lives or dies because their freedom not to wear a mask or get a vaccine supersedes Blue's right to live, Christine said. The same people that would rally around us during a transplant are those that won't get a vaccination. At one college in Iowa, students are required to be vaccinated and masked, but Chance, a disabled student there, said that his biggest fear was realized soon after arriving on campus. People simply weren't following safety protocols, he said. Enough students were ignoring the mask mandate that the dean of students sent. Enough students were ignoring the mask mandate that the dean of students sent an email urging students to remain diligent. And there aren't remote options for the fall semester, even for students like Chance, who are more vulnerable to COVID-19 than the general population. My school could have done a lot more, Chance said. Living with a seriously elevated risk of COVID complications and mortality, the past year has been traumatizing in ways I haven't even fully begun to realize. For Allie, a junior at a university in Washington who has spinal muscular atrophy, the lack of remote learning resources is disappointing but not surprising. 4-year institutions have always been elitist and inaccessible, she said. They cater to exactly one type of student. For students with disabilities, families, careers, and other extenuating circumstances, remote learning is more accessible. During pre-corona times, people like me were made to feel that online accommodations were impossible, and now we know they're not. Education needs to be made accessible for all. In signing up for classes for the fall semester, Allie was only able to find 1 online class out of the 3 she needed. She says the Disability Resource Center at her university is working on official accommodations, but that would take months. And in the meantime, it's up to individual professors to offer accommodations. Luckily, my 2 professors doing in-person classes are willing to work with me, so I only have to come on campus once a week for an hour, she said. But still, she worried, even if she only goes to campus once a week, she'll be exposed to thousands of students. With lungs weak enough that a common cold has landed her in the hospital, she's terrified of contracting COVID and becoming one of the hundreds of thousands of Americans who die from it. While senior year is known to be a time of celebration and joy, Sandy's, who is 22, is marked by fear. She has chronic fatigue syndrome and dysautonomia and uses a power chair. With her New Jersey university returning to full in-person operations, Sandy is afraid she's going to be left in the dust. As a mobility-impaired student with energy limitations, I found that virtual classes suddenly enabled me to fully engage with my education, Sandy said. Before COVID, Sandy said she often missed more than half of her classes because of the stress and energy requirement of getting to class and sitting upright for hours on end. Sandy's worried that she's going to be forced to take a medical leave of absence because of the lack of remote options. I think it's important to recognize that taking a medical leave is not easy and not feasible for a lot of people, financially, emotionally, physically, and is in no way a valid replacement for accommodations. I think vulnerable students are being brushed aside so that the majority of students can pretend that life is normal again. The next article is titled, What Happened at Nancy Lublin's Crisis Text Line? Lublin's Departure, Internal Strife, and Where They Are Now. This article is by Audra Henrich and was published September 14th of 2021. Last summer, as the coronavirus pandemic and the nationwide battle for Black lives raged on, a different kind of revolution was taking place. Only it was not in the streets, but a boardroom. And like many protests in the United States last year, it was led by Gen Z and millennial employees, particularly BIPOC employees. Recently, corners of corporate America have seen a slow but significant internal upheaval with young employees declaring racism, wage gaps, and repressive bosses unacceptable via virtual walkouts and digital campaigns. Thanks to the outsized impact social media has on all of our lives, no industry, from media and technology to hospitality or even wellness, is exempt. As that change continues, the same young people demanding justice in all corners of their lives are simultaneously experiencing a mental health crisis. Crisis hotlines across the country have reported surges since the start of the pandemic and following the killing of George Floyd. States like Massachusetts, Indiana, Michigan, and California have recorded spikes, and a June 2020 study conducted by Pine Rest Christian Mental Health Services showed calls to suicide hotlines were up 47% nationwide during the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, with some crisis lines experiencing a 300% increase. The founder of Empower Work, a crisis hotline solely for workplace issues, told NPR in late March of 2020 that incoming texts and calls had increased 200% in the previous week. All of this together created the perfect storm at Crisis Text Line, a global nonprofit offering free 24-hour, 24/7 counseling via text messaging to those in need. In June of 2020, Crisis Text Line employees staged a virtual walkout, refusing to attend any work meetings or continue work that day. Former employees of both Crisis Text Line and Do Something, a digital campaigning nonprofit for politically engaged young people created and, for a time, led by the same CEO, took to Twitter to share their experiences from the respective entities via scores of tweets hashtagged Not My Crisis Text Line and Do Something Did Nothing. Accusations against former CEO Nancy Lublin ranged from microaggressions to racism, favoritism, and overworking employees for the sake of the business. For many close to the respective companies, the claims lodged against Lublin weren't a surprise. Around the same time, the board of Crisis Text Line released a statement saying they were made aware of allegations by an anonymous letter compiled by employees back in 2018. Claims included in the letter, which was more widely publicized in a 2020 story by The Verge, varied from incidents of racist stereotyping that Lublin gifted a PhD in chicken wing certificate to a Black female employee at an office event, to fat shaming that Lublin considered offering a Weight Watchers program as she thought the staff had too many fat people, and finally, to Lublin's penchant for yelling and banging on furniture during meetings when she was met with questions she didn't like, or if she wasn't pleased with an employee's presentation. In their update, the board announced that they had voted to terminate Lublin. With an enduring pandemic, a potential mental health crisis on our doorstep, and young people continuing to demand transparency from the institutions they rely on, what comes after Crisis Text Line's own crisis? In a statement from a spokesperson, Lublin said she wishes only good things for Crisis Text Line. She declined to comment on specific allegations. Last year, after she was let go, a spokesperson for Lublin told The Verge that many of the complaints about Nancy are coming from disgruntled and anonymous former employees. According to its website, Crisis text line came from the rib of Do Something. As detailed in a 2015 story in The New Yorker, it was conceived following an incident in which a young woman sent a text message to an employee charged with teen outreach. Her father had been sexually abusing her, she wrote. With nowhere to turn, the staffer suggested RAIN, which stands for Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, and informed Lublin, then the Do Something CEO, of the incident. When it remained on their minds days later, Lublin and the employee got to work on developing what eventually became Crisis Text Line, essentially a hotline for young people grappling with their mental well-being. To the press, Lublin referred to herself as a tech CEO, mentioning how crucial data was in measuring the success of the company and citing impressive statistics regarding how many people Crisis Text Line helped since its inception. The New Yorker profile noted the merriness of the then shared offices of Crisis Text Line and Do Something, citing the aquarium, lingering balloons, and a disco ball. It also mentioned that of its 80 staff members, only 14 were over the age of 30, likening observing them, with some without shoes, to watching kids work together on a school project. Employees Teen Vogue spoke to said, there wasn't a human resource department at either Crisis Text Line or Do Something for much of Dublin's tenure as CEO of the respective organizations, and that Lublin, with her noted make more with less philosophy, seemingly saw no need for one, though that was not mentioned in their profile. Many small companies don't have HR departments, and estimates vary as to when creating one becomes essential. Lublin would serve as CEO of Do Something until 2015. Hiring young, idealistic people, often right out of undergraduate and graduate programs, was one of Lublin's many hallmarks, according to former and current employees. A number of current and former staffers agreed that both Do Something and Crisis Text Line having young staff members with a passion for helping other young people was an initiative was an initial incentive to join. Many said it didn't take long to notice tension once they were hired, though, and not between the staffers. A former engineer at Crisis Text Line felt that Nancy hired young people without much experience in the workplace because they could be molded and wouldn't understand that a lot of the things at Crisis Text Line were not normal, such as not having HR, in that person's opinion. Former head of training Patty Morrissey described something similar in a blog post about her own experience at Crisis Text Line in Medium. In it, she described her team as incredible people, smart, hardworking, compassionate, adaptable, and open to the wild ride that is a startup culture, and cited instances in which she, as their manager, actively worked to shield them as much as possible from Nancy's abuse and unreasonable demands. Morrissey also acclaimed Lublin never considered her opinion in regard to promotions and special project assignments. The mentality and the way that they chose to lead the organization was one where A, you should be grateful to be here, and B, we made you who you are. We took a chance on you, like we're going to make or break your career. Some former employees note that there were trends in terms of whose career Lublin was supporting. In Morrissey's Medium post, she shared, at one point, she, meaning Nancy, decided to create rotating leadership positions that would change every few weeks or months. The white women on my team were the ones chosen for the roles, overlooking the black employees who I flagged as high potential. A number of staffers, including black women and other men and women of color, say they felt like they were often reduced to their race and more obvious identifiers. In an email exchange with Catherine, a former Crisis Text Line employee who identifies as South Asian, Lublin sent hashtag curry in response to a business matter. Catherine was offended, but presumed she was hearkening back to a conversation in which she promised to take Catherine for the best curry of her life. Meanwhile, Japanese American employees like Eric and Adam, both of whom have now left the company, say they were repeatedly told by Lublin to open the kimono, in conversation specifically about user data when she felt they weren't being transparent enough. The expression isn't that unusual in business, but Adam was still uncomfortable. I remember gently telling her the history and connotations of that phrase and how it felt to me, said Adam. She dismissed my concerns outright as not valid, telling me that she had studied abroad in Japan and she couldn't believe that I felt that it was racist. Then she used it a few more times in front of me. My first red flag was the interview process when she entered our first meeting speaking Japanese, Eric echoed. In an interview with Sal Giambacco, a former colleague of Lublin's, Giambacco heavily praised Lublin, calling her brilliant and dismissing claims of racism, saying some of the other claims against Lublin are unfair. Giambacco added that Nancy doesn't have a savior complex, but instead is perhaps too invested in doing good. In my work as a human capital expert, the issue that I normally face is not savior syndrome, but founder syndrome, meaning the founder can't get out of the way, he said. I've seen a lot of social service organizations reach their limit because the founder can't get out of the way. By 2017, Crisis Text Line had become a leader in the mental health hotline space. In a New York Times opinion piece about the nonprofit, author David Bornstein reported that more than 3,700 volunteer counselors comprised the platform and had exchanged 56 million messages, a number that was expected to double within a year. We're in a growth industry, Lublin told Bornstein, because pain is a growth industry. According to the active tracker on the website, upwards of 142 million messages have been exchanged since its inception in August of 2013. I'm going to have to truncate this article because it's a bit long. Despite efforts to make an environment at Crisis Text Line better through actions like town halls, new leadership like top physician Shari Turner, MD, MPH, and shows of leadership among staffers, a number, including Eric, an engineer with Crisis Text Line, ultimately have decided to resign. Even though it's a nonprofit and it's social good, we're still situated within the superstructure of corporate capitalism, Eric said. We can do as many reforms and little trainings, but it's not going to change. For some staffers who remain following Lublin's departure, no change has seemingly been sufficient enough to give them more confidence in the organization. I do think a part of me staying, and what I've learned from a lot of my coworkers, is that a lot of people are really tied to the mission. We're here for a reason. Nancy was not that reason. Well, we've now run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazine. Please be sure to listen next time. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.